I would like, if I might, to start by noting one of the most significant findings of fact made by the trial court.
Counsel, before you get the finding
of fact, let me ask a question. Hopefully, counsel for the other side will be able to respond to this on rebuttal. To the extent that the United States Senate will make the ultimate decision here, and to the extent they don't have to follow what we do, how do we issue an opinion and without having it be an advisory opinion? In essence, do we have authority to do anything here?
Your Honor, this question was raised with the district court as to whether or not the court had jurisdiction. The court found, and we believe appropriately so, that the court had jurisdiction to determine who received the most lawful votes, even though the Senate had within its jurisdiction to decide who is seated. That is indeed the holding of a case from South Dakota that involves now Senator Manchin, but Congressman Manchin's first election. And it is a distinction that Routledge, the Supreme Court, adopted, albeit under slightly different circumstances, that the ability of the state process to move forward, so long as it does not impede the Senate, does not deprive the state court of jurisdiction. So I believe the court has jurisdiction to proceed. It is no secret, obviously, that I stood here once before suggesting that a certificate of election should issue so that the Senate business could proceed in the interim, but the court spoke not very clearly on that point. But I don't think that there was a suggestion in that opinion that the court, that there was a complete lack of jurisdiction. I think that that such a finding would have been inconsistent, candidly, with the court's ruling in the Franklin v. Plenty case.
To the question here is, who got the most legally cast votes? And what I want to know, really, is your position on the merits of paragraph 16 of contestant's offer of proof. In that offer of proof, that's the one Justice Beeson referenced during his questioning. In that offer of proof, and specifically exhibit C-1013, I mean, you look at the first ballot in there, the first envelope in there, and it appears facially that that was not a proper absentee ballot. And what I want to know is, if we're supposed to decide who got the most legally cast votes, and there's evidence that suggests that illegally cast ballots were accepted. Now, I understand we can't tell who they voted for, because that horse is well out of the barn. But how can we tell who got the most legally cast votes?
Well, Your Honor, this is part of the problem and frustration, candidly, with appellate's case. We have a valid envelope. We have a copy. We know that voter voted. We don't know if the voter got a different ballot. We don't know if there was a Wakawa situation involved. We don't know what the facts and circumstances are other than a copy of an envelope. And one of the, there is perhaps no fact that was more clearly established by more witnesses being asked a question and testifying directly than a phrase that was used by one of the first witnesses from the Secretary of State's office, which is that every ballot tells a story. That was a phrase that resonated through this very courtroom day after day, witness after witness, that you cannot do, as appellants tried to do in the trial court below and are trying to do before this court, to take broad brushes, that here are categories of ballots, because as many ways as there are to cast a ballot, there are ways for ballots to be rejected or non-compliance with the law, and to be corrected when diligent local officials contacted voters, reached out to voters, looked into the facts and circumstances behind the voters. So candidly, being offered a written offer proof, one of the first of which came the day of impeachment.
Forget the procedural niceties. I mean, your point, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, your point is, look, it was his burden to prove it. He didn't prove it. He can't stand up here now expecting it.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct. And if I might, the finding of fact that I wish to call to this court's attention, which goes to this point, is from the March 31st order of the trial court,
So the universe of ballots properly pled and about which this trial took place stands at 299. Now, obviously the margin separating the two candidates is 312. As a result, even if every one of those 300 or so ballots for which voter registration was proof, doesn't mean the witness was registered, doesn't mean that the certificate was properly completed, it doesn't mean that they only cast one ballot, but they were at least registered. Even if all 300 of those were for the appellant, and even if all 300 met all of the other requirements, it would still be impossible for the appellants to make up the difference. And since the jurisdiction of the trial court and the jurisdiction of this court is to determine who received the most lawfully cast ballots, the question answers itself. Al Franken received more lawfully cast ballots on Election Day than did Senator Coleman.
Counsel, were any illegally cast absentee ballots counted and included in the vote total?
I will answer that two ways. One is to say that there is nothing in the record identifying a specific ballot that was in the vote totals. I think it is fair to say that in every election, in every state, in every county, in every precinct, there is some ballot somewhere where a felon voted and it wasn't picked up, where someone wasn't registered and skirted around the table, where some other irregularity took place and it wasn't caught. But that has never been the standard in the state or anywhere.
Now, well, let me phrase it this way. So, I mean, we're talking here about the universe of Minnesota absentee ballots. You would have us, you've got a broad lens. You look at the whole universe, you say there is some intelligent design mandated by statute, and there is not chaos. It is order. There may be some, and you can see some aberrant star systems or galaxies, however you want to do it. Now, what Mr. Coleman is saying is that he focuses on, look at this aberrant galaxy. Look at this aberrant. This is proof that the universe is chaos. And in fact, is that they've shown me that. They show that there's some chaos in this universe. Now, it's been pinpointed. Tell me why they have not shown us enough that we should not implicate due process and equal protection here, because it's that, we can't see the whole universe, but they've shown us enough to show there's a problem, and it implicates due process and equal protection.
Your Honor, I have several answers to that. The first is the trial court, reading this court's decision in Bell, correctly noted that the time to challenge an unlawful vote is before it is separated from its envelope. It is at the time that the ballot is delivered to the precinct. And
but counsel, I the problem I have with that is many of these were counted by absentee ballot boards in the metro area, and I don't see anything in the statute that would provide an opportunity for Coleman to challenge an absentee ballot board. And I certainly don't see any indication that he would have received notice, or either candidate would have received notice. But it seems to me we have those categories that would have been on that outside envelope that there was no opportunity for Coleman to object to, and we're now left with what's on the return envelope at the precinct for which he could have, I suppose, under the statute, objected to, just like an in-person ballot.
I think with that, I'm correct. I think Your Honor answered the question in the last statement, which is that ultimately you could have objected to those at the precinct, and though it may have been difficult to do so.
But there are, counsel, some that would have been on the outside envelope that was not part of what went to the precinct that he would have lost the opportunity.
I believe that the outside envelope goes to the precinct along with the ballot. I believe they're separated out of the precinct. The outside envelope is reviewed for determination of whether it's accepted or rejected at the absentee ballot board. But I believe,
okay, well, setting that issue aside, we're now at the precinct and we have the return envelope. What innocent explanation, if any, is there for these ballots in C 1013 that don't have the voter's signature? It seems to me that that is a clear requirement and on its face clearly not complied with. So, is there an innocent explanation? I'd like to
there,
may have been a replacement ballot. We don't know. We stand here being told that there are, quote, some 4,400 ballots. Some 4,400 ballots. Some subset of some 4,400 ballots. This court ought to go back and take an amount of, but we're using the brief and using them today argument, an amount of practices through each of the counties. After the election's concluded, the court ought to set the standard based on what the amount of practices was, and to determine which of the some 4,400 ballots that were presumably cherry-picked by counsel and by the appellant to meet their other needs, and figure out which count that delivers.
Counsel, what's the answer to my question? Is the lack of a voter signature a voter signature is a statutory requirement. And absent that, it is indeed a properly accepted ballot, isn't it?
It is indeed, Your Honor, but again, we don't know the story behind that ballot. And in this courtroom, we heard...
What would be an innocent explanation that why that would have occurred?
That there was a replacement ballot. That the individual was unable to sign their name because they were handicapped. Unable to write. That I don't know what the other reasons are, but there are stories behind these ballots. There are reasons why the election officials accepted and rejected ballots, and simply appending them to a document on the last day of trial and delivering them to us is not evidence. It's argument. And Your Honor, I specifically point this court to the finding to the court's ruling that this argument was waived for failing to properly plead it. And failing to properly identify these ballots as in response to discovery requests. These exact questions that Your Honor correctly asked today are questions we asked before trial. Tell us which ballots they are so that we can go out and prepare for trial.
Counsel, let me just explore that with you for just a minute. I certainly see findings from the panel that there weren't an answer to an interrogatory. But going to the statute, a notice of contest has to set forth grounds. It doesn't say that a pleading has to contain legal theories like due process, equal protection. And it certainly doesn't say that in an answer you have to plead all affirmative defenses. And certainly here you didn't plead waiver. So if we follow your waiver argument, you didn't plead waiver, so you waived the right to plead waiver.
Your Honor, our concern was not the failure to plead due process or plead equal protection. It was a failure to identify the ballots. Which ballots? Don't tell us there are some 4,400. Which are the ballots? So that we can do what we need to do to prepare for trial, which is to go out and look at those ballots and find out the answers to the very questions that Your Honor asked me. What is the story behind this ballot? Every ballot tells a story. What's the story behind this ballot? And we asked that question before trial again and never received an answer. And it was not until the close of the case that the ballots were identified. And at that point, it was obviously too late. The waiver that I believe Your Honor refers to regarding the pleading on the part of a cause was the due process claim, where equal protection was pled. And during oral argument, I sat in this courtroom and for the first time heard Roe versus Alabama, a case which I'm quite familiar with, uttered as part of the closing argument. Now, whatever notice is required of a claim of a due process violation, it clearly must come before the contestants close their case in argument.
So let me switch subjects here a little bit. The equal protection and due process claims, what standard do we look to in reviewing those claims?
Well, I believe Your Honor correctly identified that if you look at both the federal rules of constitutional law and state constitutional law, that absent a case that involves a burden on a suspect classification, which is kind of a separate type of equal protection or due process claim, there is no allegation in this case that we have a burden or either intentional discrimination or a burden on suspect classification. That absent intentional or purposeful discrimination or arbitrary treatment that is so extraordinary that it undermines the fundamental fairness, then there is no violation.
Counsel, that isn't the standard that we applied in Erlinson, though.
I believe, Your Honor, in Erlinson, the court noted the adopted something, it appears to me, in my reading, akin to either arbitrary and capricious or rational basis. So it was a low level of scrutiny. Whether you look at Erlinson, or frankly, whether you look at Timmons or Burdick, which are the sort of more sliding scale approaches, the administration of elections, which is really what we're talking about, receives the highest deference by a court. The states must be able to write laws about how ballots are going to be sent out, how they're going to be received, how they're going to be processed, and how they're going to be counted. If you hold that up to heightened scrutiny, then you will put sand in the gears of allowing an election to take place.
But you would concede that changing the rules after the election is a violation of fundamental fairness.
Indeed, Your Honor. And indeed, the changing of the rules would be to say, let's hold an election. Then let's figure out what all the counties did, create an amalgam of that, and then apply that standard to the past election. The clearest way to avoid a problem under the due process clause and under the case law of Romeo, Alabama, and Briscoe, and Griffin, is to have the court enforce the law as it's written. And this court has made crystal clear through a series of cases that when it comes to absentee, the requirements for absentee voting, there is mandatory requirement with the voter's responsibility to comply with those provisions. And the clearest way
Justice, to... Now, I want your cites to that and the law, because that's a question I asked contestants to address on rebuttal. So when you cite that, I mean, just what is your authority that it is mandatory and, in fact, the change would be to do a substantial compliance instead of strict compliance?
Well, Your Honor, I would point you to Whitman in the city of Glencoe, which this court said, and I quote, the provisions of election laws require acts to be done imposing obligations upon the elector, which are personal to him, are mandatory. He is personally at fault if he violates them. If his vote is rejected for such violations, it's because of his own fault, not that of the election officials. Such provisions prescribe mandatory conditions precedent to the right of voting. This court has been as clear as Whitman, and I can also point you to Bell, where they cite with a quote extensively from Whitman and add an additional emphasis to it. But I don't believe there is any doubt with respect to absentee voting as to the mandatory nature of the requirements on the voter. And with respect to the second part of your Honor's question, the due process problem of this, if you look at the facts of Roe, you are struck that Roe stands for the proposition that a statute that requires proper witnessing for absentee ballots cannot be lowered by the state court after the election has taken place. So if this court is concerned about a potential Roe violation, the easiest way to avoid that is to simply apply the statute as the trial court did, as it is written, not as it might be better written by the legislature, not as it might be rewritten by the legislature. I would add an observation along these lines, Your Honor. Minnesota is one of a handful of states. I practice in election law throughout the country, and Minnesota is remarkable for the lowering of the barriers that take place to allowing in-person voting. It is one of the most friendly and progressive states when it comes to getting in-person voting. That was a legislative judgment that the state made. And every time it made that judgment, it could have said, you know what, we're going to follow the lead of Oregon, we're going to follow the lead of Washington, and we're going to make vote by mail easy, we're going to make absentee voting easy, and they chose not to do so. And that was a conscious choice that if you look at the Crawford decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, where they upheld an Indiana statute involving ID, they identified the legitimate interest that a state has to prevent fraud and cited specifically.
Can I just go back to Erlinson for a minute? I mean, we said there at page 732, treating similarly situated voters differently, with no rational explanation, the statute violates equal protection guarantees. And so that's the argument that's made here, is that similarly situated absentee voters are being treated differently. And you would articulate the rational explanation for that different treatment as what?
As the need for the counties and the precincts to have the flexibility to allow elections to work. The fact is, in Pine County, where there may be one street called Main, in Minneapolis, there may be 20 streets that have Main. So in Minneapolis, you may need a different standard for whether or not it says Main Street, Main Avenue, Main Boulevard, whether it has a directional.
Is there evidence in the record to support this rationale?
the difference in interpretation that counties brought and personnel brought to be satisfied. And I point this court to that operative word. If you read the statute, what it says is that the election judge must be satisfied that these requirements are met. And that term satisfied obviously connotes that there is going to be some measure of discretion involved, some reasonable discretion that puts the grease in the joint, so to speak, that lets the election take place on one day, at the same time that the election judges have to keep the lines from getting too long, the polls open on time, keep disruptions from happening, make sure that new voters are getting registered, make sure that people are getting orderly through the equipment. They also have to be processing these ballots.
It sounds like substantial compliance, which is, of course, exactly the opposite of what you're arguing.
Your Honor, it's not substantial compliance. The requirements are mandatory in all respects. The fact that a county official, an election judge, one Democrat, one Republican, working together, might use different pieces of evidence to meet their need to be satisfied, doesn't mean the law should be the same everywhere. The requirement that a witness be registered, for example, point that that appellants make much of, that is the law in all 87 counties. In different counties, there are going to be different practical considerations to how the election judge satisfies themselves that they are registered. In some counties, they're going to satisfy themselves by looking up the answer to the arrest record. In some counties, that's either not available to them because they don't have the technology available or because it would just simply be impractical. So they rely on other conditions, like the address put down by the witness. That doesn't connote a different standard, and it certainly doesn't rise to the level of an equal protection violation or anything that this court has ever held would cause doubt on an election. And in that regard, I would point, Your Honors, to the court's discussion in Green, contrasting cases like Clayton v. Prince and Berg v. Reed and subsequent to that, Hahn v. Graham, with the facts and the holding of Vetch. I apologize if I mispronounce the name of that case. In Vetch, the court Green says, this court found, quote, the officials in charge of the election committed such serious and numerous violations as to indicate not only an utter unawareness or disregard of election laws, but also such a striking absence of effort to comply with any laws that no confidence could be placed in the integrity of the election. That is because the court said, quote, an absence of all effort to comply with the law is the equivalent of bad faith. And if you look at the history of the cases in this state, the garden variety differences between counties, or the garden variety problems that crop up in every election, do not lead to a constitutional or statutory problem. It is only where you have this complete failure, this complete absence of any standards, this complete absence of any effort on the part of the election officials to comply with the law, that this court has held that there is a cognizable injury to a contest. And that squares completely with the holding of the U.S. Supreme Court in Bush v. Gore, where again, the Supreme Court said it was a standardless recount. It was a standardless recount that took place under the auspices of a court, where a court could have imposed standards, and simply turned a blind eye to the standards, so that you have some counties doing partial recounts, some counties doing full recounts, some counties counting ballots one way, some counting ballots another way. There is nothing in the record of this case, and nothing in the trial court's findings in this case, that would suggest that level of problem.
Counsel, you bring up Bush versus Gore, and you've talked about some long-standing principles that apply in equal protection. Why aren't those long-standing principles about intentional discrimination go by the wayside in light of Bush versus Gore? And is it Bush versus Gore, at least with respect to election law, puts in place a different standard that those long-standing principles don't apply anymore?
I think what Bush versus Gore says is that you can have conduct that becomes so arbitrary, that it's so egregious that it essentially rises to the level of intention. And I think what the court found in Bush, and it's the reason why we have not argued, as others have and many in the future will, that Bush versus Gore was a one-and-done case, no presidential benefit. I think it's fair to read Bush that though it had presidential value, the court was clear in limiting it to a really unique set of circumstances where you have conduct, where you have a court overseeing a
recount. And let's remember, in that recount, these ballots in this recount were open. Governor Bush's team knew what the score was, and Vice President Gore's team knew what the score was. The veil of ignorance about what was in these ballots had been lifted at that point. And they were looking at completed ballots. And without any standard in that circumstance, with a court standing by and letting these ballots be counted by whatever standard the election officials came up, you had an extreme example of where gamesmanship by the two sides could take place. Because they knew if they ruled that the standard applied in a certain way to a certain ballot, they knew what the outcome would be, because they in fact had the ballot in front of them. It was open. None of that was present on election day in Minnesota. In Minnesota, you had hard work, and the trial court found it clear, and it was the testimony of every witness, you had hard work from Minnesotans who went and did everything. They tossed the good to administer a fair election. And yes, they used the different tools available to them in the different jurisdictions to make that work. But that's not why we did that work.
Counsel, your time is